This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Welcome to the Dreamers Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Pardo, and today I am interviewing Kip Mataluki, who is living his dream through travel, language study, and theater. Welcome to the show, Kip.
I'm glad to be here. It's very nice, Joe.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming out to the studio. Why don't we get started by giving some background about yourself?
Okay. I'm from Pensgrove, New Jersey, raised in Pensgrove and graduated from Rehigh in 1969. Pensgrove's claim to fame is that Bruce Willis also graduated from Rehigh. He's 4 years younger than I am, so I can't say that I, you know, really hung out with him too often. Anyway, that's where I graduated from high school. And then I went to Wake Forest University in North Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and got a degree in German in 1973, and fell in love with languages when I took a trip to Germany in 1967 with my high school teacher, fell in love then with languages and travel. And I was pretty sure when I got back from Germany that summer of 67 that I wanted to do something with languages. And it turned out that teaching would be the thing that I would do. Spent 34 years teaching at Gateway Regional High School, German. I also taught French there for a year, and I taught Russian there for about 7 or 8 years as well, during the height of the Gorbachev era when Russia was so exciting. You know, I introduced Russian to Gateway. So I also, I retired there from there 3 years ago. And since then, I've been doing as much traveling as I can and studying languages, going to as many plays as I can. And I also sing in a chorus, the Greater South Jersey Chorus. And I'm squeezing as much as I can into my life, you know. While I still am able to travel, I hope there's still a few good years left in there. Because I like to bicycle, I like to hike, I like to do things, I like to swim, I like to do things, like travel sort of actively and vigorously. I figure that I'll travel that way until I'm a little too old for that, and then maybe I'll travel by cruises, which I think are a little more relaxing. And one day I might be too old for that, and then I'll just have all these wonderful memories to look back on.
So what countries have you been to?
Well, it started out with Germany when I was a 16-year-old. We were in Germany and Austria for 6 weeks, 3 weeks in Düsseldorf, and we would travel to different places there. We studied during the day and traveled to different places in the area. And then we transferred to this beautiful little alpine village called Seefeld, and we were 3 weeks in Seefeld, and we saw some cities in, you know, Austria as well. And I mean, suddenly, you know, I was surrounded by the Alps and medieval fortresses and cathedrals, and I just fell in love with the experience. Because at that time, there was no Skype or anything like that. You communicated with your friends and family back home for the 6 weeks through letters. That was it. And I must have been homesick at times, but I don't remember it. That was the first, certainly for 6 weeks, that was the first time I was away for 6 weeks. And the only other time before that, it had been a week at Boy Scout camp. Somehow, and I don't remember anybody else in the group particularly getting, you know, homesick either. And I've taken a lot of kids to abroad, and for sometimes 3 weeks in the summer, sometimes for, you know, 10 days during spring vacation. And homesickness, even, you know, in that short a time, can be a problem with young people. But for some reason, I was born for it, I think, for travel. And that's when I fell in love with it. Well, France, you know, I studied French, Switzerland, of course, and Russia, the Soviet Union, the first time I was there. Then Tallinn in Estonia, and Georgia, Soviet Georgia. We were kind of all over the place in the Soviet Union. We were in the Crimea, in Ukraine, Yalta. And then I hadn't been to South America too much. I was in Cuba for a week with the World Affairs Council, but I hadn't really been to South America much. So I decided I want to explore South America a bit. And 3 years ago, maybe four, I was in Buenos Aires in Argentina for a month studying Spanish. And I really fell in love, you know, with the culture and the people. And then I decided to study Spanish some more after that. I was tempted to go back to Argentina, but I thought, you know, there are other countries in South America. Why don't you explore, you know, some of them? So I spent 2 months in Peru. And I guess I could go on, but those are, you know, those are the big ones anyway, the big countries anyway. Canada. I've been to Canada. And England, of course. As well, yeah.
Do you want to elaborate how you got to Soviet Russia when it was Soviet Russia?
Yeah, I used a tour company called ACIS, American Council for International Studies, from when I traveled with high school students. And they had a college program, a program for college students. And I was not quite college age then. It was 1979. I was 28. But I applied for this program that was 6 weeks in the Soviet Union. You were in Moscow for 3 weeks and then 3 weeks in what was then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And I was in this group study tour for 6 weeks. And it was, you know, the adventure that you might think it was. I have Soviet friends, now Russian friends, dating back to that period of time. We were in Moscow first, and we were there for about a week, and we were complaining that the only Soviets who would talk to us were black marketeers who wanted to buy jeans from us or wanted to, you know, buy records from us because, you know, even rock and roll was frowned upon. And so there was a black market for all these things from the West. And then one day I was coming home from some kind of an event, and there was this, the door was opened, the room next to me, and this guy was seated listening to something, and he asked me if I had a football jersey. And he was a Soviet, and they segregated Soviets from Westerners in hotels, strictly. I'm not sure why it happened, but we were put in a hotel for Soviet citizens and Eastern Europeans. And it turned out to be very fortuitous, because I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't have a football jersey with me. And he asked for a football jersey because anything with English on it, you know, could sell on the black market for, you know, $100. And you know, it would be, you know, cool to wear. I said, no, I don't, but I'm in a group of 15 people, you know, Americans, and, you know, I can ask around. I'm sure one of them has. And he invited me in. He said, well, sit down. And he pointed to this portable cassette recorder, and he said, Voice of America. And it was the Voice of America, but it was the Saturday night disco program, and Donna Summers was singing Love to Love You, Baby. And then these three other guys walked out, and they turned out to be water polo players who were participating in something called Spartakiad. And it was like the Olympics, but it was all throughout the Soviet Union. It was a major thing. And depending on how well they did there, they could have played on the Soviet Olympic team. And 1980 was the year that Moscow hosted the Olympics, and we would boycott the Olympics in 1980. We would lead a boycott of the Olympics in 1980 because the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. But in 1979, none of that was foreseen. And it turned out that I found myself there in this room. You could see the Kremlin towers out the window, and I was talking with Olympic caliber water polo players. I'd never met a water polo player in my life, let alone water polo players good enough to play on the Olympics. And Donna Summers was singing Love to Love You, Baby. It was surreal. I could have been in a nightclub in Philadelphia. And that night, we were having a 4th of July party. So I invited them. And it was, you know, amazing. I mean, you know, drinking and singing and laughing. And around midnight, you know, after we had, you know, been drinking for some time, they suggested that we go to Red Square. And because it's all lit up at night, and it would be very nice. So we did. And it's a wonder we didn't get arrested, because you can imagine, we would all been drinking a lot. And there was nobody else in Red Square at that time. And we were, you know, looking at the mausoleum where Lenin is, and that's always guarded. And I guess we knew enough. I don't quite remember, but we must have not been too loud. But that was a big adventure. Then after a couple of days, they told us that their coach had told them that they were getting too friendly with the Americans. And we said, well, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to not, you know, talk to you or anything like that? And they said, no, we can be friends with whoever we want to be friends, you know, but really you shouldn't call us because the phones here are probably bugged, and maybe we shouldn't meet too much in the hotel. Outside of the hotel, we should meet. And, you know, we did. We had this 3-week friendship with these Soviet water polo players. And it was just amazing, really, because they were in Moscow for 3 weeks, and so were we. And then we transferred to Leningrad for another 3 weeks. A couple of days after we arrived in Leningrad, they came back home, which was Leningrad. So we were all worried, you know, that we would we weren't meeting any Soviets. They were too afraid to talk to us, except for the black marketeers. And then suddenly these water polo players, you know, fell into our laps. And for almost the 6 weeks of our stay, we were, you know, hung around with these water polo players. And it was just a, you know, remarkable experience. Athletes in the Soviet Union were treated very well. You know, if they were good enough, they were even able to travel to the West. These athletes hadn't traveled to the West. But I think it was their first experience with, you know, sort of the cruelty of their system. You know, they liked us. You know, we liked them. In a normal country, we would have been friends and there wouldn't have been any problem. But they actually had to worry that after we left the Soviet Union, they would be interviewed. I mean, they knew they would be interviewed by the KGB. They figured that the KGB would interview them and satisfy themselves that none of us were spies. And so, and everything would be fine, but they still would be interviewed and it still would be in their file someplace. They actually, you know, worried about that. And that was my first experience in the Soviet Union. And I remember, you know, thinking there were shortages and the stores were, it was hard to imagine that the stores, the so-called supermarkets, you would walk into a so-called supermarkets and there would be, you know, milk, you know, one kind of cheese, which kind of really wasn't cheese at all. It was kind of maybe like Velveeta, you know, one kind of lunch meat that, you know, looked like bologna with big fat chunks of fat, you know, in it. And some, you know, salt and pepper bread. But there were so few products, you know, available. There was, you know, toilet paper. It's famous. There was always a lack of toilet paper. There were all these shortages all the time, all these lines all the time. And I remember thinking, you know, we are afraid of these people. You know, they can't supply their people with toilet paper. And, you know, these are their stores. They're ridiculous. You can't find anything in them. There's the black marketeer for black market for everything. And then I had to remind myself that even though, you know, it looked like a third world country to us, they had a formidable nuclear arsenal. And, you know, that was what we were competing against. But it was a wonderful experience, and I fell in love with the people, very warm, generous people. And I wanted to go back, and I did make it back several times, you know, since then to the Soviet Union. I guess the next time was under Gorbachev in 1987, and I went back for a year, a school year, studied Russian with Middlebury College. I was working on a master's degree. And under Gorbachev, things were had eased quite a bit. I mean, communism hadn't fallen yet, but there was this, it was just an exciting time to be there. Gorbachev's policies of perestroika and glasnost, which every American knew what they meant back then. I mean, glasnost was the ability to say what was on your mind, because Gorbachev thought if Soviet citizens couldn't speak freely of what was on their mind, they couldn't change things. And Gorbachev wanted to change things. And perestroika was restructuring of the economy. And it was, I think it was probably the most exciting time in Soviet history since the revolution. And there weren't bullets flying. So it was just a very exciting time to be there. There's all this change in the air. One day Gorbachev, you know, went on television and he gave an address and he mentioned Stalin. And Stalin had been a persona non grata in the Soviet Union, never mentioned in public since Khrushchev denounced him in 1954, I think it was. And so they were able to finally talk about the crimes of Stalin and the period of Soviet history under Stalin. And then another day, he got on television and Sakharov, you know, leading physicist, I think he helped them develop their neutron bomb. He became a peace advocate in the Soviet Union. And it was fine to be a peace advocate in the Soviet Union. You could say you're for peace and we're against war and we hate war, as long as you blamed all the warmongering on the United States. But Sakharov said, no, the Soviet Union is as responsible for the arms race as the United States. And he was a very courageous man. They knew he was such a famous, you know, person worldwide that they couldn't put him in prison, try him and put him in prison, but they exiled him internally. It was a city called Gorky, and that was off limits to Westerners. It was a nice city on the Volga River, but it was just closed to Westerners. And Sakharov and his wife, Elena Bonner, were put there in exile. And Gorbachev called them up and said, come back to Moscow, you know, free them from internal exile. And, you know, interestingly enough, a few years later, I got back to the Soviet Union again for a summer. And our group took a trip to Gorky, which is now called Nizhny Novgorod. It's the Russian name that the city had before the Russian Revolution. And all over the city were these posters announcing an arts festival in honor of Sakharov. So Sakharov had spent internal exile in that city. And a few years later, they had an arts festival and it was dedicated to Sakharov. And we didn't go in his little home, but his little apartment, tiny apartment that he and his wife lived in for years, is now a little museum. And we were outside the apartment. We didn't go in and take a little tour of it. Probably wouldn't have taken too long. But I remember, you know, some of our Russian friends said, you know something? You know, his neighbors were probably too scared to even say hello to him in the morning when they saw him. And, you know, now, you know, he's free and he's in Moscow with his wife. And there's this arts festival in his name. It was amazing the changes that were made.
Surprised he decided to stay in Russia.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess he just loved his country. You know, we all do. As critical as he was of it, he was critical of it because he loved it and wanted it to change, you know.
So what does traveling in language mean to you?
Well, that's a very good question, Joe. I think language learning is not just grammar, of course, and vocabulary. That's an important part of it. But you also learn about the history of a place and, you know, and the culture. And to me, it's all about breaking down cultural barriers and promoting cultural understanding. And, you know, there's a fundamental human value in my book, and that's accepting people's differences, tolerance of people's differences. And language learning has helped me to do that, and that was what I tried to emphasize to my students. I mean, I never preached to them about accepting people's differences, but it was really important to me that I teach the culture of the German-speaking peoples or the Russian-speaking peoples, as well as, you know, the grammar. And through food, which is a lot of fun to integrate into a high school classroom or even a college classroom, and through observance of the holidays, through watching German movies or Russian movies, through listening to German rock music or Russian rock music, I think eventually most kids absorb this value that it's not weird or dumb or the way, you know, the Germans do things or the Russians do things. It's just different. And I think they came to respect, you know, these cultural differences. So that's a very important thing for me. I've always hated bigotry as long as I can remember. If I did anything in my 34-year career to help, you know, wipe out bigotry just a teeny tiny little bit, then I'm, you know, very happy. As a matter of fact, that this promoting of cultural understanding was even more important to me as a teacher than teaching the language. Most kids took 2 years of German in high school because that's all they, you know, needed to graduate. And most colleges require a couple of years of a language. And anybody who studied a language for 2 years know that you don't, especially in high school, knows that you don't learn very much. And in 10 or 20 years, you'll know, you know, even less than you knew when you, you know, left high school. So most of my students probably forgot most of the German that they learned in 2 years. But hopefully they developed an appreciation perhaps for German music, rock music, or for German films, or for art, or for culture, and had a better cultural understanding of Germany. And that's been sort of borne out to me through Facebook, believe it or not. I've got some 1,500 friends, and most of them are former students who go back to 1977. And I used to show, for example, at Halloween — the Germans really don't celebrate Halloween like Americans do — but there was a German director during the 1920s, which was a great era for German film, Murnau. And he did a film called Nosferatu, a silent film called Nosferatu, which is based on the Dracula story. It is the Dracula story, but Bram Stoker's widow was still alive then, and she wouldn't give him the rights to film it. So he said, "Okay, I'll film the novel, and I'll call it Nosferatu, and all the characters will be different names." That's what he did. And even today, that 1922 Nosferatu is considered, you know, one of the greatest horror films ever made. And I have students who watch that. And to, you know, to sell a 1922 silent horror film, you know, to kids, seventh graders and eighth graders, I would make fun of that. I was, you know, the same effects, special effects that scared your great-great-grandparents to death are kind of, you'll find Rinky Dink and all that. And so I'd sort of poo-poo that. But a lot of them got into it. And to this, every now and then around Halloween, I'll get a message on Facebook. "You know, Mr. Mataluki, my wife and I, or my husband and I, and our kids sit down every Halloween and watch Nosferatu. It's become a tradition." And it just warms my heart that it might be the only silent movie they will ever watch. But, you know, I introduced them to this great German expressionist silent film. And that's, you know, that's borne out a number of communications from former students, how I opened them up to this a new world, the culture of, you know, Germany, the culture of Russia, and that's very gratifying.
I'm sure it is. What would you say inspires you?
I guess it boils down to just a curiosity about the world around me. And if I had had a German teacher who wasn't very good or who wasn't very nice or wasn't very interesting, I'm not sure what I would have done. I might have, you know, I've taken a lot of other languages. You know, I might have, you know, still taken that path. But Mrs. Cote was a remarkable woman. And, you know, I went to Germany with her and for the first time when I was 16. And I fell in love with everything about it. I guess it's just she opened a new world for me, just like a lot of my students tell me, you know, I opened a new world for them. I had been into Philadelphia before as a kid, to Wilmington as a kid, but I hadn't traveled too much even in the United States, you know, as a kid. And suddenly I find myself in Europe. It was beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And I just fell in love with it. And I guess that's it. It's a curiosity about the world around me because I've studied French, I've studied Russian, I'm studying Spanish. I had a little bit of Norwegian. I'm going there this summer for, you know, for a month to study a little more of it. I've dabbled in all these languages and I just am fascinated by all these. I had some Chinese in, you know, in college. I'm just fascinated by all these cultures. I mean, they're diverse and really not connected to each other. But the thing that I guess drives me is a curiosity about the world around me. I want to learn as much about it as I can.
So you kind of just started to hint at it, but how did all this come about for you?
I guess the seeds were planted with Mrs. Cote in Pensgrove, New Jersey. We had the elementary school, I guess, was across the street from the high school, Carleton. When we were in the sixth grade, 1962, I was in the sixth grade. Cuban Missile Crisis happened then. Mrs. Cote came over once a week for an enrichment program. Then I think it continued in seventh grade as well, just once a week. And I'm sure she didn't teach us much other than, you know, numbers and colors and, you know, days of the week and, you know, greetings and things like that. We didn't learn a whole heck of a lot. But when I was to sign up for high school, I thought to myself, well, you know, you've had a couple of years of German. You've had an introduction to it, you know. I liked her. I liked it. Why not take German? Most of my friends took Latin. I know. That was the, you know, language of choice for most of my friends. But I took German. I took Latin my sophomore year in high school because I, you know, most of my friends were in Latin and I thought that would be cool too. The Latin teacher was also, you know, an excellent teacher. But that was where it started. It started with Mrs. Cote coming over in 1962 when I was in the sixth grade coming over. And she just, you know, woke this up. And then, of course, when I traveled there, that was it. After that, I knew there was going to be something with German. The story of the United Nations, I think most kids who major in a language have dreams of interpreting at the United Nations, and I did too. And when I was a junior in high school, we went to New York for the day, and we visited the United Nations. And all my friends knew that, you know, I wanted to go to college and, you know, maybe get a job interpreting for the United Nations. And one of them, we were looking at all the flags, and one of them said, "Yeah, Kip, the German flag isn't there." I said, "Well, sure it is." And I'm looking, you know, on all the flags. Oh, you're right. It's not. And when I was 16 or 17, I didn't realize that neither Germany, neither the German Democratic Republic, Communist Germany, or, you know, the Federal Republic of Germany, you know, West Germany, was in the United Nations because we blocked East Germany's entrance and the Soviets blocked West Germany's entrance. And so neither country was in the United Nations. So when I was 17 years old, my hopes for my future career were already dashed because there was no German. But there are, you know, of course, lots of other things you can do with language that are more realistic than, you know, interpreting at the United Nations. That's a pretty hard job to get, actually.
Well, you said that you interpreted for CNN.
For NBC, when I was in the Soviet Union under Gorbachev the second time, in May, President Reagan came over for a summit with Premier Gorbachev, and the networks hired interpreters. And I worked for NBC, and I did anything they wanted. As a matter of fact, we went in a week early and unloaded I think it was something like 3 tons of television equipment and other things to prepare for the summit. And one of the things we unloaded was case after case of Heineken beer for the crew and the staff. And there were 2 full rooms in the Rossio Hotel stacked with beer. And at the end of the summit, you know, a week or so later, there were a couple of cans of beer left. So the people of NBC really enjoyed their beer. But I did everything they wanted me to do. I interpreted some. I laid cable on top of the American Embassy in Moscow because President Reagan met with some Soviet dissidents in the American Embassy. I laid cable in Moscow State University. In Moscow State University, we had to go through the dean's office. And of course, helping the cable guys to lay the cable, I interpreted because they didn't speak, you know, any Russian. And that was how the interpretation came in. We had to move a sofa in the dean's office, so I asked if we could move the sofa. And behind the sofa were portraits of the 2 previous Soviet leaders, Chernyanko and Andropov, 2 old men. They were old men when they were appointed, and they died within a year, I think, of office. And they had been taken down to put up the portrait of Gorbachev. And it was something so Soviet about it, so Russian about it. They, you know, out with the old, in with the new. They didn't even bother to throw them out. They just took them down and left them behind the sofa. And they were framed portraits of these 2 leaders. I thought that's amazing. So I asked, you know, the dean if I could have them. Oh, sure. You know. And so I have them to this day. But it was you know, fascinating, of course. Then I would, you know, we'd go out in the van, and they needed footage of Soviets reading Pravda. There were these bulletin boards encased with glass, and they would put Pravda up there. And Soviet citizens would gather around and would, you know, read Pravda before they were, you know, would get on the subway system, the metro, they call it. We couldn't find anybody. And he said, "Kip, I said, well, why don't you just use, you know, old footage?" And he said, "Well, there will be Russian speakers who will see, you know, the date, and will know that it's not, you know, today on the Pravda." I said, "Okay." He said, "Well, look, go out and round up some Soviets and ask them if they'll go over there and pretend they're reading, you know, Pravda." And yeah, you know, I did that for NBC. You know, it's funny because every now and then you hear reports of news being staged, and that was no big sin. I mean, they do that. We just couldn't find them doing it, you know, while we were looking for them. But I helped NBC sort of stage that little footage. And then they went into the classroom and did an article in the classroom. And I didn't have a computer in 1988. I didn't really understand them at all and was a little bit afraid of them. But there were already laptops then. And I worked with a laptop. And we had to translate something like 8 hours of footage in the classroom. And it was fascinating because the teachers were able to, for the first time under Gorbachev, teachers were able to really discuss what was happening in their country and not lie about it. And the students were able to say what was really on their minds and criticize, you know, Gorbachev and criticize the government. And all this, you know, exciting stuff was happening. So we spent some time, you know, doing that. And then I got a job working on the Today Show. And Brian Gumbel and Jane Pauley were the hosts then. And Brian Gumbel was in Moscow and Jane Pauley was in New York. And I worked on the set. If Brian Gumbel said, you know, "The light's in my eye," I told the Soviet technician, "The light's in Brian's eye. Can you move it?" I did whatever I, you know, needed to be done in the way of translation. That was, you know, very exciting. I fetched coffee for Secretary of State Schultz, George Schultz. I did anything they needed me to do and was happy to do it. I was there when Tom Brokaw would give the nightly news. NBC had its headquarters on the balcony, that third floor balcony of the Rossio Hotel, and with a breathtaking view of the Kremlin Towers and Red Square as a backdrop. And so it was, you know, very, very exciting, you know, doing all those things for the summit. Tom Brokaw and his wife hosted a party in their apartment in Moscow for the whole staff. Well, I was a lowly member of the staff, but I was part of the staff, so I was invited to a cocktail party with, you know, Tom Brokaw and, you know, his wife and, you know, his rival but good friend Peter Jennings, who did ABC. He was there as well with his wife, and it was just cool. Maria Shriver was there because she was working for NBC at the time. It was just an exciting time in my life, you know. We were paid $100 cash a day. That was it. Now, the days were long. They were 12-hour days, but I didn't care. I would have worked 16-hour days for $100 or for free, probably, because it was just such an exciting thing to do. And ABC, CBS, and NBC paid $100 a day. CNN did not. It was mostly students. and so CNN said that it was an internship, and they would write a letter, you know, for anyone who needed it, saying, you know, how good the person worked in television, how much the person learned about television. But that was their payment. It was like a student internship. Nowadays, in situations like that, CNN probably pays whatever the networks pay. But at that point, they didn't.
So how was your dream received by your family?
You know, it's interesting. It was encouraged. My first time abroad at 16, my father was a little more nervous about it than my mother. My grandparents paid for half the trip, and my parents paid for the other half of the trip. I got my spending money together. But at that time, you were getting 4 marks to the dollar, which is kind of like getting 4 euros to the dollar today. I mean, you could live like kings and queens then in 1967. So you didn't need much to enjoy yourself. It's funny. Like I said, my mother was less concerned about being away for 6 weeks than my father. My father focused his concerns for his 16-year-old son on what was scheduled to be an afternoon tour of East Berlin. Our group spent a long weekend in Berlin, and we went through the wall. And my dad thought, they're gonna kidnap me for my brain. I mean, I was kind of smart, but I was no Einstein. Nobody would kidnap me for my brain. But he was concerned about my being away from home for so long and concerned about going into East Berlin and the Cold War and all that. And it became kind of a running joke in the family that, you know, God help mom if they kidnap me, you know, because she'll never hear the end of it. But when we were seated on the bus to go through the wall, our guide told us the do's and don'ts, you know. Don't bring any, you know, Western newspapers in there or, you know, Western magazines in there, Time or anything like that, because, you know, they're censored. Don't really talk to East Berliners when you're over there. You really won't get in trouble, but they could get in trouble because it's such a close society that for all the police know, the East Berliner is having a lively conversation with an American spy. You know, and they did get us, you know, really nervous, the adults as well as the students, because our teacher chaperones were probably going into a communist country for the first time too. And then at the very end of her spiel, the tour guide made a very well-practiced joke. She said, "Now, don't worry too much, please. At least 75% of all the people who go into East Berlin come back the same day." And it cracked the ice. We all laughed. But at that point, I thought of my father. I thought, oh, dear God, please let me be one of the 75%, because if I'm not, my mother will never hear the end of it. You know, mom will never hear the end of it. But, you know, as I said, they were really supportive of it. And neither my mother nor my father really ever traveled much. My mother kind of had a desire to travel, but it never happened. And my dad was perfectly content living in his own backyard. His sister, my Aunt Joy, lives in Baltimore. And to my father, making a trip to Baltimore was a very big deal. It was, you know, a little bit outside of his comfort zone. So he was never going to get to Europe. But even though I was thinking about him, of course, recently for Father's Day, my dad was very supportive, even though, you know, my things weren't his things. You know, my dad was a great athlete when he was in high school. And he probably, you know, figured out early on that I was never going to be a football hero like he was. But he never made me feel inferior for that. He never, he didn't need to relive his life, his glory days from high school through me. He always supported what I was interested in and, you know, encouraged me to, you know, be myself, which was pretty cool, especially for a guy from his generation, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice when family members can put their own beliefs or their way of life aside for your way of life, so that you can do what you feel is right for your life.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly true, Joe. And I saw that, of course, with the students, some of them really forced by their parents' wishes to go to one college over another because the parents wanted them to do one thing rather than another thing. You know, somebody who really had a leaning, a love of the arts and was sort of encouraged by or really kind of forced by his parents to, you know, go to MIT. Because his parents wanted him to do that. And he wasn't very happy there. And, you know, now is, you know, very happy. He did find his way eventually. But it wasn't at MIT, you know, majoring in a science. So I've seen that over the years a lot. And I'm just very happy that, you know, my parents were supportive of, you know, what I wanted to do with my life.
So what steps did you take to get started in teaching?
I got into teaching kind of through the back door in a way. I've always been interested in languages and travel, but also in religion and theology. I was raised an Episcopalian, and I was always, you know, fascinated by that. And I majored in German at Wake Forest, but I minored in religion. I took enough courses in religion at Wake Forest to major in it, actually. I debated for years whether I would do something with languages or become an Episcopalian priest. And it took a while, but I made up my mind to, you know, become an Episcopalian priest. There was a seminary called the Schoda House, which is about 30 miles outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I applied there and was admitted. And in the fall of 1975, I went out there. And I quickly discovered when I got there that there was more arrogance than God in my call to be a priest. And I really didn't think that that was the right path for me. So after just a couple of months there, I left. And of course, that was a very difficult period in my life. I had had this dream of becoming a priest for years, and suddenly, you know, that dream was shattered. And I had to decide, you know, what I wanted to do with my life. I had a degree in German, but I didn't have a teaching certificate. And then I found out that I could get a teaching certificate through what was then Glassboro State College. And I took the necessary courses to get a teaching certificate, you know, at Glassboro State College. And I think it took 2 years. But in the fall of 1977, I became a teacher. And fortunately, it was what I was meant to do, I think, all along. And you know, there was enough of a pastoral dimension in teaching to sort of satisfy whatever need there is, you know, in me to do that. And it became a career that I loved. And when I think about it, I've traveled so much, mainly because I had the opportunity to travel. I had the summers off, you know, while teaching. I had, you know, 10 days in the spring, and I could take students over to Germany. And had I become an Episcopalian priest, I certainly would have done some traveling, but I wouldn't have done anywhere near the amount of traveling that I was able to do as a teacher of German. It was fortuitous. If I had found out that I didn't like teaching, I don't know what I would have done. Maybe I would have tried to get that UN gig, you know, after all.
Quick question. You were a teacher when you went to work for NBC?
Yes, I was on sabbatical. Gateway had a sabbatical policy, and I took a year off to study in Moscow. It was wonderful, and I was very fortunate because a lot of high schools don't have sabbatical policies. And Gateway no longer has it, which is a shame. But in 1987, they did. And it just turned out to be, the year to go to the Soviet Union. I mean, a couple of years earlier, Gorbachev had come into office, but these policies hadn't really gotten off the ground yet. And a couple of years later, it was a coup or an attempted coup against him. He survived the coup, but that was the end of this era. Yeltsin took over, and then the country went to pot for a while, and now it's still trying to regain its footing. It was just a very exciting time in Soviet history to be there.
So what roadblocks have you hit along the way?
That's a good question. Well, dropping out of Neshota House was a big roadblock along the way, I would say. That really threw me for a loop. I eventually, got out of the funk after that and started taking these courses. So that was a major roadblock. And then I've been lucky with these trips. I've had a couple of, misadventures, but nothing that I didn't survive because I'm here, talking with you. I was very lucky. Gateway is a wonderful place to work. I had great friends there, and I enjoyed a wonderful career. There was a potential roadblock when I spent that year in the Soviet Union. They hired a teacher to take my place for that year. And she came into a very difficult situation because most of my students liked me. And, she was only going to be there for a year, and it was difficult for her. But I guess word got out that, the German teacher, they hated the German teacher, and, the German enrollment fell. There was a time, I think, when my job there was in jeopardy, not because they would have fired me, but just laid me off, because even if a tenured teacher doesn't have the kids in the classroom, then the tenured teacher is out of a job. But again, Gateway was very supportive and gave me a couple of years to do a little extra recruiting for German, and my colleagues in the language department understood it and didn't feel threatened by it. And it did take a couple of years to build the enrollment up again in German, but I did. But I often think back on that. And if Gateway had been less supportive or wanted an excuse to drop German and save some money, they could have. And I would have been a 38-year-old in the middle of his career trying to find, you know, another job. And whether I would have been able to find another teaching job or not, I'm not sure. So that was a potential stumbling block. But fortunately, because everyone was so supportive, it didn't happen. And I remember when I first got the job at Gateway, my mother wrote me a letter, you know, congratulating me on getting the job and giving me some other motherly advice. And her main advice was to keep my mouth shut and not to mess up. And the day I came into the house, my mother's been gone for 11 years, but my last day at Gateway, I walked through the door and I said out loud, "Mom, I didn't mess up. I didn't necessarily keep my mouth shut, but I didn't mess up. You'd be proud of me." I left the job, you know, a well-liked teacher, you know, who kept German alive for 34 years, and you'd be proud of me. And I'm sure she was, wherever she is.
How did you overcome not being a priest anymore? What kept you going through that period?
Well, that was a difficult time in my life, but I fortunately had good friends and family who loved me, and, you know, that was hard. And I was depressed for a while. I left the seminary in, you know, late October, but I did find out that in February I could start taking education courses at Glasgow State Teachers College. And once I began doing that, I met people, you know, made new friends. I was being stimulated intellectually again. And gradually I came out of this funk that, you know, I was in. But it was not an easy, you know, an easy time in my life, because it took me years to decide to become a priest, and I had made up my mind to do it. And then I got out there and found out that it really, you know, wasn't for me. And I was told by the dean that it was probably best that I leave and spend some time thinking and, you know, reflecting. And but if I decided to come back, they wouldn't make me go through it, the admissions process again, that I would be, you know, accepted right away. And after the thinking and the reflecting, I realized, you know, that it was not the path for me. I thought that Neshota House was very, was almost monastic. There was a lot of time spent, not just in academics, but in chores around the campus and in reflection and prayer and meditation. And I wasn't sure, you know, I knew there was some arrogance in what I thought was a call from God to do this work. But I thought that after 3 years of praying and, you know, meditating at Neshota House, it would chip away at whatever arrogance was there, and I would be able to understand what really was inside, whether it was really a true, you know, calling from God or not. And I didn't get a chance to do that. I left very early, but I did my reflecting and praying afterwards and realized that I did make the right decision. I never did go back to Neshota House.
Well, it seems like you turned out pretty well.
Well, thank you very much for that. I hope so. Yeah.
Is there any parts of your dream that haven't quite worked out yet?
Well, I can't say that there are. It's always been my dream to explore as much of the world as I can and continue studying languages. I was very lucky with the position at Gateway. I've been very lucky in my, you know, retirement. And there are some things in the back of my mind, like the Peace Corps. I've always thought that that might be a great thing to do when I'm ready. The oldest volunteer is apparently 80, so I've got a few years to decide, you know, before that. But so far, so good. Knock on wood.
So is there a favorite memory you'd like to share?
There are so many. In Goethe's Faust, the deal that Faust makes with Mephistopheles, the devil, is that if he can ever say to a moment in his life, "Linger, thou art so beautiful," then the devil can have his soul. And the devil thinks he can make him happy by giving him love, romantic love, and that doesn't work out, or by giving him, you know, fame and fortune, and, you know, that doesn't work out. But there is a point, you know, when he's able to say to this moment in his life, "Linger, thou art so beautiful." In German, it's "Verweile doch, du bist so schön." And it's one of my favorite quotations. And we've all had these moments in our life when we want them to linger because they're just such beautiful experiences. And I've had, you know, many of them. I've been lucky enough to have, you know, many of them in my travels and otherwise. There are just so many. Salzburg is one of the most beautiful cities on earth. and there's this medieval fortress there. And I remember being was with kids, and the kids were exploring this medieval fortress that I had been to with kids, you know, 15 times before, and I was there once as a kid myself. It was a beautiful spring day. There was a Baroque, you know, concerto in the plots in the square down below that I could hear wafting the sound. It's a beautiful spring day. The birds chirping. I'm sitting on the walls of a medieval fortress. And I said that, you know, linger, thou art so beautiful. It was one of many moments in my life that I've wanted to linger because they were so beautiful. I've been very, very lucky.
So you mentioned a little bit before, but what do your dreams for the future look like?
As I said, do as much travel as I can. I like to travel vigorously. I like to swim. I like to hike. I like to bicycle. And I'm thinking to myself that I'll travel that way as, you know, long as I can. And then after I get too old to travel that way, I'll take cruises. And one day, God willing, I'll, you know, live long enough so that I'm even too old to take cruises. My German teacher from high school, Mrs. Cote, she lived to be 95. And I called her a week or two before she passed away. And she was still sharp as a tack. We talked about the headlines in the paper that morning. We talked about ourselves and, you know, what she was doing, what I was doing. She once told me that, Kip, now that I'm not able to travel anymore, I have all these wonderful memories. I sit, you know, here in my chair, and I think, which little pub was it where such and such happened in Hamburg? Was it the one across the street from the, you know, from the castle, or was... And, you know, she said, Kip, it's very rewarding. It's wonderful that I had this lifetime of memories to look back on. And when she was saying that, even, I thought to myself, you know something, one day I'm going to be in the same boat. Lord willing, I'll live long enough to be too old to travel. And when I'm too old to travel, I'll have all these memories to look back on. So that's what I'm, you know, that's how I'm hoping it will work out. As far as unfulfilled dreams, the dream of the Peace Corps, it is a dream. And I'm not sure. I always prided myself in the fact that, gosh, I lived a year in the Soviet Union. I wasn't living, you know, in a hut with a dirt floor, but it was difficult living in Moscow in 1987. You know, food shortages and fresh fruit and vegetables in the winter. And they turned the hot water off for a couple of weeks just randomly. I mean, there were problems in coping, you know, with living, being an American there and being pampered. And I've always prided myself in the fact that, you know, I'm still able to. I could, in the Peace Corps, sleep on a cot or in a hut if I needed to, you know. But now that I'm getting a little older, I'm wondering about that a little more, how that might work. A two-year commitment to living in the middle of nowhere and maybe in conditions that aren't so comfortable. Because as you get older, you know, I have arthritis and things happen, you know, and it's not as easy to live less comfortably as it might have been 20 years ago even. So we'll see. But that has been a dream for a long time, and we'll see if it happens or not.
So is there any last thoughts you'd like to share?
I'd like to thank you for this invitation, this occasion. It's been really great talking with you. I would like everybody who can to get out of their comfort zone and, you know, travel. I meet a lot of people who say, you know what, I've always wanted to travel, but I've sort of never gotten around to it. And of course, your life can go by saying you've always wanted to travel and, you know, have never gotten around to it. And I think there's kind of a fear of the unknown, which is very human. I fear the unknown as well. But, you know, if I let the unknown keep me in South Jersey, I never would have gone anywhere or done anything. And so I like that. And of course, being a lover of the theater and a lover of choral music, as I am, I would recommend for everyone to go see a play and, you know, go to a choral concert, because they'll enrich your lives. The theater and choral music can enrich your life. I'll leave you with those thoughts.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really glad that you took me up on the invitation.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
And that we got to meet.
It's been a pleasure.
You have a website that you plan on updating at some point, right?
I do, yeah. I have a blog. I mentioned earlier, that I use Facebook as kind of a blog. I write about my travels and upload pictures and, you know, and that kind of thing on Facebook. But I also have a blog called Tales to Tell. And I transferred from some stories and some photos onto that blog. And when I did it about 3 years ago, I had every intention when I retired of really working more with it, and but it hasn't happened yet. But you've inspired me, as a matter of fact, to revisit it and do something with it.
Well, we'll get the link and put it in the show notes.
Okay, thanks very much, Joe.
Well, yeah. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.